stimulated under effect and parametrically induced decoupling or transparency. I've been trying to, you know, choose which name to give it. So the talk is going to be split into two parts. First part is going to be about this paper that Dalila mentioned. I'm going to tell you about stimulated Unruh effect and acceleration-induced transparency. And then the second part, I'm going to introduce a generalization of acceleration-induced transparency in general interaction scenarios. And it's called parametrically induced. Okay. So the first part was published, as Dalila said, and the second part is unpublished, but I wrote it up in my PhD thesis, and it's been submitted. So let's go to the first part. The reason why we worked on the simulated Unruh effect and acceleration-induced transparency, well, it's because we were curious about acceleration in quantum physics. We would like to know more about how acceleration fits into quantum physics, and in particular, more than just the standard Unruh effect. And the reason why we're interested in that is that acceleration is related to gravity via the equivalence principle. So learning something about acceleration in quantum physics might teach us about gravity and quantum physics together. So today I'll tell you about new acceleration-induced phenomena. These two combined will give us an increased measurability of the Unruh effect, and it will give us new insights into acceleration and gravity. So when I'm talking about the Unruh effect and light-matter interactions, I know that not all of you are experts in this field. So I'll tell you about these interactions. They split into two different kinds of interactions, resonant ones and non-resonant. So the resonant ones are the usual ones. They are everywhere around you, absorption and emission. They are strong, which is why they are usual. They are everywhere around you in the sense that the resonant transitions are responsible for everything that you see and how you see it. So yeah, they are strong, and that's why they are everywhere around you. And we know that these kind of interactions can be stimulated. That means that the probability for seeing those kind of transitions can be increased greatly by presence of photons in the fields. And the way you do that is you just turn on the laser during your experiment. You pump up a lot of photons in your field, and that increases the probability of those transitions. And then on the other side, there are non-resonant kind of transitions. They are unusual. They are responsible for the Unruh effect and the Hawking effect, and they are weak. And because they are weak, that's why they are unusual. And you have to activate them by either acceleration or gravity, otherwise you don't see them. So in, you know, Unruh the detector in inertial motion doesn't see those kind of transitions. So the new thing I'm going to show you today is that the resonant transitions, which are typically strong, can be modulated with acceleration or gravity, and this will lead us to a new phenomenon called acceleration-induced transparency. And on the side of non-resonant transitions, we'll show that non-resonant effects can also be stimulated, just like these ones, and that makes them more measurable. So as I just said, the Unruh effect can be stimulated as well. That's what we are going to be talking about today. As we already know that the resonant transitions can be stimulated, but here we'll stimulate the Unruh effect by the presence of photons in the quantum field. So this will increase the probability of seeing the Unruh effect greatly by many orders of magnitude, but there will be a problem that arises, which is that stimulating the Unruh effect also stimulates the resonant transitions. And when you're trying to measure the Unruh effect, that's a problem because you only want to see the Unruh effect. The resonant transitions are kind of spurious. You want to get rid of them. And so in order to get rid of resonant transitions, we are going to use acceleration-induced transparency, which is this new phenomenon I'll talk about later, that will suppress the resonant transitions to zero. And we are going to be left with just strong non-resonant interaction terms or non-resonant transitions, and that will lead to a strong Unruh effect. So for people who haven't seen this math before, I'd like to show you how we calculate the standard Unruh effect. This is one of the ways you can do it. The setup is very simple. You have, on one hand, you have an Unruh divided detector. It's just a two-level quantum system with an energy gap omega. And you have a scalar quantum field with, you know, it's simple free Hamiltonian. Then they interact with this interaction Hamiltonian. There's a coupling constant G. Then on the side of the detector, we have the flipping operator, sigma x. And the field interacts along the trajectory of the detector. So this is the trajectory. And when you look at the interaction Hamiltonian in more details, you can see how it splits up into these different kind of interaction terms that I was talking about, the resonant ones and the non-resonant ones. The resonant transitions are the ones that either excite the detector while de-exciting the field, or the other way around, while the non-resonant ones are those that either excite both of them at the same time or de-excite both of them at the same time. And the standard Unruh effect involves in calculating this kind of amplitude, where we go from the ground state of the detector and the vacuum state of the field to the excited state of the detector. We want to calculate the amplitudes for that to happen. We work in first order perturbation theory because the coupling constant G is assumed to be small. And then when you do this calculation, it's simple, you get an expression like this. This is some kind of a normalization. Coupling constant G appears here. And then the most important part, I'd say, is this time integral I plus. It's defined here. You can think of it as a Fourier transform of a phase function that arises from the trajectory. X mu is a trajectory here. So it's this kind of a time integral that determines the strength of the Unruh effect. It directly depends on the, you know, the strength of this, on the size of that integral. Okay. So that was old stuff, the standard Unruh effect. Now I'm going to tell you about the stimulated Unruh effect. So the setup is the same Unruh divided detector, two-level quantum system, scalar quantum field, same interaction Hamiltonian. The difference is that the field starts out, instead of in a vacuum state, it starts out in an excited state. And in this case, I'm going to use a Fock state. So there are n photons in the field. By the way, I'm saying photons even though it's a scalar field because this is a toy model for light. Okay, so here we now calculate the amplitude for transition similar to the standard Unruh effect, except we're starting out in a different initial state. And we find the final state to be something like this. This is the Unruh contribution, and this is the resonant contribution. That's the, you know, the biggest difference here is that we get this square root of n enhancement of the Unruh effect, but also we get the contribution from resonant transitions. And this is the thing that we are going to have to get rid of. So just a table of comparison, whereas the Unruh effect starts out with the field in the vacuum state, the stimulated effect starts out with the field in an excited state. And when you calculate the probability of the standard Unruh effect and compare it to the probability of the stimulated Unruh effect, you find an enhancement, n, which is the number of photons in your field, which is great because n can be a very big number. But also, at the same time, you get this resonant contribution, which you want to get rid of. And so I just wrote down here, you know, probability of excitation is enhanced by n, where n is the number of photons in the field. Okay, so let's talk about this resonant contribution. We don't like it. We only want to see the Unruh effect in an experiment. So the way we do it is by focusing our attention to these time integrals, I minus I plus. They are different for the resonant and the non-resonant contribution. The difference is this: are these signs here, minus and plus? Okay, so people who work on this know this very well, but I'll tell you guys, we know how to eliminate the UNRU time integral very easily. As long as the UNRU Debye detector is moving on an inertial trajectory, the UNRU time integral is always equal to zero, whereas the resonant time integral can be non-zero. If you hit the right velocity, then you get the resonance here. So it integrates into something that's non-zero. But what we are going to do here is we are going to flip this around. We are going to try to see if we can set I minus, so the resonant contribution, to zero, while having I plus non-zero. So that's kind of a new way of thinking about it that hasn't been done before, which is why acceleration-induced transparency is a new phenomenon. So the question is, can we tune the trajectory of the UNRU Debye detector such that for some detector with energy gap omega, we have that this time integral, I minus, which I remind you is the resonant time integral, such that this time integral is equal to zero. What this will mean is that we just turn off the resonant contribution to the probability of excitation. Okay, and so the answer is yes. We showed that for some trajectories, such as this one, where you first start out in some inertial motion, then you change to another velocity, and then you end up in some other inertial motion. So if you tune these parameters correctly, you can have I minus be equal to zero. Then we also showed that for a smoother trajectory, it's also true. We can also tune the parameters so that I minus is equal to zero. So in other words, we showed the existence of this phenomenon of acceleration-induced transparency, namely that there are trajectories of the UNRU Debye detector which cause I minus to be zero, and therefore all resonant transitions for that wavelength of light are suppressed, completely suppressed. And so what that means is if the detector has an energy gap omega, if we see that it got excited, it definitely did not get excited due to resonant terms. Meanwhile, the I plus integral that comes from the UNRU effect is non-zero. So if the detector got excited, it got excited due to the non-resonant, you know, UNRU type terms. And the way this curve looks like is like this. Basically, this tells you the absolute value of the I minus integral. This is kind of like an absorption curve for resonant transitions. It has two resonant peaks. And in between those resonant peaks, there's this point where if you tune your trajectory to that point, you suppress resonant transition to zero. And if you zoom into around that point, you see, whereas the resonant transitions are zero, the UNRU type transitions are above zero. So, you know, if you now stimulate the system, you pump photons into the field, you increase the probability, you multiply the probability for both resonant and non-resonant by, you know, 10 to the 15. But because this is zero and this is something finite, this gets increased a lot and this just stays zero. Or you can look at it, you know, in a more realistic way. If it's not going to be exactly zero, but if you can tune it to be approximately, you know, if you can tune it to be 10 times smaller than the UNRU type transition, then when you multiply it by a big number, the ratio is still the same, right? Then, yeah. So that's also good for experiment. Okay, so what we should is, you know, we can stimulate the probability of UNRU effect, we get this prefactor n, but we also get prefactor n for the UNRU effect, but we also get this prefactor for resonant transitions. Then we kill those off by using acceleration-induced transparency. And what we are left with is dominant non-resonant terms, strong UNRU effect, and it represents a new method to measure the UNRU effect in the lab. So those are the two new effects that I wanted to tell you about. Schematically, the way you can think of this is that simulated Unruh effect is n times bigger than the standard Unruh effect. And if you take some modest approximation for how big n is, how many photons you can pump into your field with some modest laser, it's a big number. It's 10 to the 16. So that's a lot, and that's why that's a cool new way to measure it in the lab. And just as a comment, because I already said in the beginning that gravity and acceleration are related, we all of us know that. But it's interesting because they are related. For example, the acceleration-induced transparency suggests that there is also the phenomenon of gravity-induced translucency, gravity-induced transparency. That basically means you influence the strength of resonant transitions for Unruh de Witt detector, which you can think of as an ion or something like that, due to its trajectory in a gravitational field. And then also, because we showed that we can stimulate the Unruh effect, and it's very similar to the Hawking effect, we can also think about stimulating the Hawking effect, for example, by photons present in accretion disks. That's something for future research. Okay, if you have any questions, maybe that's a good place because I'm going to go to the second part of the talk. Yeah.
Maybe an obvious question, but yeah. On paper, are there any issues you see with you doing this with a non-scalar field?
When we were in the refereeing process, we had to argue for that. The difference is that you just have to make it vector-like. So, for example, with the acceleration-induced transparency, if I remember correctly, you can do it, for one direction of light and not all of the directions of light, stuff like that. But it's nothing crucial, which is why they accepted the paper. Yeah.
So you showed the calculation for an n particle state, correct?
Yeah.
More general ones, such
yes.
As coherence state and all that?
Yes, I cut out that slide. Usually I also tell, so basically, as long as the expected number of photons is n, it's the same result, follow through.
And the other question is regarding, because like you're shooting light to say an f or something, right? That's
yeah.
The other drawing I give you.
Yeah, well, we're envisioning it, I guess, as an electron in a magnetic field. That's what creates a two-level quantum system.
All right, so you want to use the spin of the electron,
yep.
The magnetic field in order to do that. I see. And then to uniform accelerate that to a temperature to an acceleration that would correspond to a temperature that would be meaningful. But at the same time, when you start shooting laser into something, right? That laser will bring energy itself, right? It will produce an excitation that itself,
even if
it's solved, right? If it's solved, you show the non-zero, you would get a non-zero excitation probability. Right?
Yeah.
So essentially the argument is that there is this very specific range of parameters such
mm-hmm.
that the laser would not excite anything if the other effect was not.
Mm-hmm. So we actually calculate exactly what happens, with the transitions, right? We use the presence of photons to enhance the probability of transition. Are you asking me how the absorption of the photon affects the trajectory?
I guess it's just like if you shoot light, what happens? You see getting excited, no matter the trajectory or the left or whatever.
Yeah.
That's not something surprising in the sense that we would see this anyways, right? But it's like you have something very specific about the trajectory such that this shouldn't happen unless we were seeing non-resonant.
Yes, unless you have some acceleration, some non-inertial motion, yeah.
Okay. And finally, do you is the temperature of the reflect is directly proportional to the acceleration, right? So can you reduce the acceleration required?
To
prove the artifacts.
Okay, so you remember the trajectories that we use here are not the standard Unruh trajectories where you have eternal acceleration. So these accelerations, you know, shouldn't be anything astronomical. It's not the same comparison, you know, to the standard Unruh effect, because in particular you don't have eternal acceleration. So the success of all this doesn't depend really on these being large accelerations. The success of this depends on how nicely you can tune these trajectories and then how many photons you can pump into the field. There's kind of different problems that you're facing. Fine-tuning of the trajectory plus how many photons you can pump into the field.
Fair enough. But then you won't see like a temperature that is proportional to this.
No, it's different.
All
right, thanks. Yeah.
So the action that you use to use like scalar model runner energy would be just to simplify calculations?
I can't hear you.
Oh, just like use scalar model runner to simplify the calculations and like raise on the fact that it wouldn't, like your conclusions wouldn't.
No. Yeah, we use, you know, one of Eduardo's papers to argue that this is a good model. And then, of course, you know, there are some changes, as Aidan said. It's not vectorial scalar field, but it's not significantly different.
And later on, when you mentioned the lasers, like, that is part of like a proposal of a protocol to actually do an experiment for this?
Yes, yes. So one of my collaborators here is Vivishek. Let's see. Vivishek, he's an experimentalist at MIT. And he's actually currently, you know, trying to design this experiment. Yeah, and one of the things, the way we envisioned creating these kind of trajectories, we actually write about that in the supplementary information of the paper. We envision engineering those trajectories by using static, electric, and magnetic fields. So, you know, there are proposals for kind of all parts of this thing. Now someone just needs to do it.
I think it sounds like very misbetuned a lot. Right?
Fine-tuned, yeah. Yeah, problem for experimentalists. Okay, are there any more questions? We have more time, 5 minutes. Okay. So while I was working on the acceleration-induced transparency, after a while, I stopped thinking about it, but I just realized at some point that the way we shut down the resonant transitions in this model I just talked about is that we manipulated the trajectory. And what trajectory did for us there, it allowed us to have some kind of a parametric control over the interaction Hamiltonian. And then we could shut down some transitions. So I figured I could just do that generally. I can just say, hey, if I have some parametric control over the interaction Hamiltonian, I can shut down some transitions. And it's a generalization of acceleration-induced transparency where the parametric control was given by the choice of trajectory. So I'll tell you how this works. So this is all preliminary, unpublished, and so on. So let's see. The setup is the following. We have a free Hamiltonian H0, and an interaction Hamiltonian that we can control to some extent. I'm going to talk about an interaction Hamiltonian, which is just a rank one projector. That's not necessary. That's just the simplest case where it already arises. So just, you know, we can have parametric control over the coupling constant or also over the projector. And I work in the interaction picture, just like in the Unruh effect thing I described. Because the interaction Hamiltonian is a projector, and I know what the free Hamiltonian is, it has some eigenvalues, eigenstates, I can very quickly write down the time dependence of the interaction Hamiltonian, nothing fancy. And then I work, just like in the Unruh effect, I work in first-order perturbation theory, so that means the assumption of weak coupling, so that means, you know, interaction Hamiltonian is small in some sense. And when I calculate the probability of excitation of going from the ground state to the excited state using this time evolution, I get an expression like this. So again, we have this e to the I omega tau. Then we have the time dependence of the coupling constant and time dependence of the components of the interaction Hamiltonian. Now, just note that the transition from ground to excited state, I just chose for convenience. You can also look at transition from any state to another state. Okay, so if you want to turn off this transition, basically, then this problem translates into a problem where you're looking for a function of time, f of t, such that this integral is zero, because this integral determines what the excitation probability is. So basically, you're looking for time dependencies of your coupling constant or your interaction Hamiltonian, which will cause that there are no transitions between the ground and the excited state. One detail is that the coupling constant is always a real number, so you only have real control over the real part of the function. You will see what that means. And this is a vector, so you have a complex number there, so you have a little bit more freedom. Okay, and the catch is that we already know a solution of a function of time, f of t, which causes the probability of excitation to be zero, namely from acceleration-induced transparency, where we found trajectories x mu such that this integral was equal to zero. Well, we can just use that. We can just use those functions and plug them into that expression. And we found what kind of parameters will cause this parametrically induced decoupling. Now, just note that this, you know, you can always choose for f of t something trivial like the plane wave. You know, then you get resonances and odd resonances and so on. But that's not so interesting. We want to see, you know, what is the whole class of these kind of functions which cause transitions to just shut down. And so if you want to decouple some transitions by varying the projector in time, so the projector is a function of time, the coupling constant is just a constant in time, you plug that into this expression, you find something like that. I remind you, we want this to be zero in order to turn off the excitation from the ground state to the excited state. And if we choose this time dependence here in such a way that this function here corresponds to an acceleration-induced transparency function, then we get excitation equal to zero. So if you chose the time dependence of your interaction Hamiltonian in this way, you turn off the transition. You can also do it with varying the coupling constant in time. Now, coupling constant is, or it's not a constant when it varies, but okay. It's a real number, so we'll need two projectors to kill off the integral because the integral is a complex thing, so you need, you know, two real numbers basically to kill it off. So we add, instead of one projector, two projectors. We get an expression like this. Maybe the details are not important. And again, you make a good choice of the time dependence of the coupling constant, and you can kill off the transition. So the message is, if you have parametric control over your interaction Hamiltonian, you can just kill off some transitions. And that's interesting for people, for example, people who are doing adiabatic quantum computing. They want to, you know, they want to turn off transitions from the ground state to the excited states in order to speed up their computation. And okay, I think I'm almost done. In summary, I showed you two new effects in light matter interactions, stimulated Andrew effect and acceleration induced transparency. And then I showed you a generalization of acceleration induced transparency, which I called the parametrically induced decoupling. These two parts showed us a new proposal to measure the Andrew effect in the lab. And the second part showed a method to switch off some transitions using parametric control over the interaction Hamiltonian. That's all.
Yeah. Hi, everyone. I'm Kiana. And I want to talk about what I was working on with Avery Broderick and EHT collaboration during the past year. So in order to come up with the introduction to give you an idea of what I'm working on. I'm working on Noether Ethereum, which basically states that in GR, any black holes that we are having, you can characterize them by their mass.
Recording in progress.
Okay. So Noether Ethereum basically says that any black hole that we have in GR, you can characterize them by their mass and spin. But recently, we can see some deviations from near horizon measurements of AHT collaboration. And we can see some deviations that in M87 black hole that we see. This is the center of M87 galaxy, and this is the image that EHD published very recently on the first image of the center of our very own galaxy, Sagittarius A star. In order to quantify these deviations, you have to come up with a very general way in order to describe it. In order to describe the whole thing for Schwarzschild case, non-spinning case, you can start with the fact, I'm going to use a chalk, if it's okay. I want to use the fact that I want to come up with a general modified version of metric. So I need to have, at least for non-spinning case, I want it to be static. And I want to have spherical asymmetry. So I need to have my components of my metric to not be a function of t and also not be a function of theta and phi. So what will be there for me would be this metric over here that you can see. And usually people just care about this nr and not br. They're like, we know for Schwarzschild, nr squared would be like 1 minus 2m over r, and we don't really care about grr because it's not like that important in comparison to gtt. But what I was trying to say, what I was trying to show, one of the things that I was trying to show is that grr component of metric is also important. And if you look at the images, what we actually have in the images, it's the darkest spot in the middle, which people call it the shadow. And we have the brightest spot, which is known as multiple photon ring. And I'm going to first talk about shadow size for this modified metric. And then I'm going to calculate the multiple photon ring for this. Okay. In order to do that, in order to find the darkest spot in the middle, I have to find the outer radius of this dark spot. And I have to show you that inside of it, the intensity, the brightness decays drastically or exponentially somehow. So first of all, I'm going to show you that I want you to believe that R gamma or photon circle radius is the outer layer of this, and I'm going to show you why. So first of all, I'm going to calculate photon circle. In order to do that, I'm going to use the metric that I had over here. I had this metric. I want to look at the null rays, so I'm going to set ds equal to 0, and then I'm going to rearrange things in order to find r dot, and in order to find the effective potential, and this is what I will have, and this b here is the impact parameter. So if we are looking at the photons, that they're coming from a very critical impact parameter that will end up in circular motion. So this is my black hole. I have some photons coming from a very critical impact parameter, and they will circulate infinite amount of time around the black hole in a circular motion. And in order to find this b, we all know that Lz, it's r cross p, and at infinity, you can see that this impact parameter, so the impact parameter, you can see that this is equal to b times p, and since we're talking about photons, this p is just equal to the energy. So you can see that Lz over E would be our impact parameter, and you can just like put it there. And you can find the effective potential, and you can set it equal to 0, because one of the conditions that you need to have in order to have the circular motion is r dot equal to 0. And then if you want to maintain having the circular orbit, you need to have r double dot equal to 0. So you take a derivative out of this equation, and you set it equal to 0. And if you solve these two simultaneously, you can see you can find the R gamma and B gamma. And I want you to, for now, to accept that B gamma is the shadow size, because you know, the circular orbit, what I'm seeing here as the observable observer would be this impact parameter. I see that there are some photons going in. They will just being absorbed to the black hole and circulate infinite amount of time around the black hole. So I cannot really see them. This and what I'm seeing is the impact parameter of that. And this is the shadow size. But in order to show you that inside this shadow size, I'm going to have a faint region. I'm going to have a very dark spot in the middle. I have to tell you about the multiple photon rings. So I claim that if you're coming with a very critical impact parameter, you will end up circulating around the black hole infinite time. But what if you go a bit outside of that B gamma? If your impact parameter is a little bit bigger than that impact parameter, for instance, with this one goes one half around the black hole and then escape to infinity. This one comes from here, circulate two half around the black hole and then gets to infinity. And this is just like kind of like consistent with our intuition. But if you want to show it, what we have to do is that we have to assume that space-time around the shadow size is smooth, the manifold is well-behaving enough that I can use Taylor expansion. And if I do that, I can say that this photon's coming from a slightly bigger impact parameter. I can Taylor expand their R double dot and say it's R double dot at R gamma plus R double dot prime at R gamma times delta R. And I know that since I'm talking about photon circular orbit, this is equal to zero for R gamma. And this is just the function that I'm calculating this at R gamma, and it's a constant. And I'm going to end up having this as my solution. So if omega is a positive quantity, it will be the same thing that I'm saying here. If you're starting from a bit outside of B gamma, you will end up circulating sometime around the black hole and you will exponentially go out. And then if you're starting a little bit inside of it, you will exponentially go inside the black hole. So you can see that the spot in the middle would be dark. Actually, it would be exponentially, the brightness there would be exponentially increasing. And people, when they usually think about, like, they see this type of behaviors, that you have this e to the power of omega t, it just looks like chaos. It means, like, if you start a little bit different, like you start a little bit outside of this critical impact parameter, you'll end up in a very different place because, you know, it's changing exponentially. And people, whenever we're talking about this a little bit changes and you're seeing a drastic effect, people call it chaos, and they work with Lyapunov component. So that's why we are moving from omega to gamma, which is the Lyapunov component, and you can see this here. And what is fascinating here is that if you will be able to find gamma, you can put constraint on this whole thing, which is also related to B, which B was our GRR component. And we can show that GRR component is actually important. People used to be like, it's not really important and you don't need to calculate that, but we showed that it can be measured. And this yellow shaded region over here is the measurement that we are having from the shadow size. But as you can see here, okay, I'm gonna talk a little bit more about this. Like the dashed line here are the GR value. And since we were talking about, most of the time we're talking about n squared, and n could be positive or negative, so you can just assume that n is positive and you can exclude this region. And this region over here, you can exclude it because we just talked about that omega should be a positive quantity. That's why we are having shadow size, we are having multiple photon rings. So I'm going to exclude this part too, and I'm going to end up having just a quarter of the whole diagram. And this is my shadow size measurement. But if I can actually measure multiple photon ring, I can put another constraint on this and I can restrict my components even more. But what's more fascinating, it's over here. You can see I use that equation here again in order to draw n prime as a function of n. And again, and we assume that n is positive, we're excluding half of the diagram. And since we know that B gamma is equal to 1 over n prime and we have shadow, which basically means that n prime should be a positive quantity, I can exclude the other half of the plane, and I'm going to end up having this part. And shadow, we have the shadow size measurement, and this yellow shaded line would be region would be our measurement from shadow. But as you can see here, this n basically could be anything from this measurement. Like, people most of the time are talking about, like, we are having deviations, which is like a little bit of perturbation from Schwarzschild or GR or anything. But you can see that as long as N prime is living in this region, N could be anything. And I feel like this is so fascinating that it actually showed us that we definitely need more and more observation in order to be able to say if GR is correct in a strong field regime, at least for the images that we are having in EHD. And what is actually measurable here, I'm going to skip it because, you know, I don't think we have enough. What is actually measurable here is that if I look at this multiple photon rings, again, I have some photons coming from different impact parameters. They will circulate different times around the black hole. Let's say this is the M1, this is M plus 1, and this is M plus 2. This one is circulating M half around the black hole, M plus 1 half, M plus 2 half around the black hole. And if I find their impact parameter and I find the relative radii between them, I can see this is just a function of gamma. So I can find gamma, I can come with the idea, with the observable quantity, which is basically just a function of my component. It's not a function of shadow size, my technical other things. It would be just a function of gamma, and we can actually put a constraint on it. And what is fascinating about this is that we know all of the, we have all of the technology, we have all of the science, we know all of the science and everything, and it's just a matter of money. If you have enough money to build some telescope outside of Earth, like put some telescope on a satellite in mid-Earth orbit, we can be able to actually measure and distinguish between these multiple photon rings. And by that, I mean, if you look at this image, you can just, you see a very faint, bright region. But if you're having more resolution, we can actually see that this is actually an infinite amount of photon rings that we can distinguish between them. And if we could do that, we can more precisely talk about deviations from GR and coming up with different modified version of gravity. So I present these things so far in EHD meeting when I was in Spain in June. And they were like, okay, all of the things that you talked so far about, they were about non-spinning case, but what if you're talking about the spinning black holes? What will happen if you talk about spinning black holes? And we all know that if you're looking at Schwarzschild spacetime, it's way more easier to talk about Schwarzschild than talking about Kerr spacetime. And I was trying to hesitate working on that, but I did. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what I've done since June. You know, in Kerr spacetime, we have the third constant of motion, which is the Carter constant. But if I want to modify Kerr spacetime, I have to ask myself, how can I modify my metric in a way that I will still have my third constant of motion? You know, I have a stationary, you know, that my spacetime is a stationary when I'm talking about Kerr spacetime. So thanks to another theorem, I'm going to have energy as a constant of motion. And I also know it's axisymmetrical, so I'm going to have LZ as another constant of motion. And I know that in my geodesics mass, I have the mass, rest mass, so I'm going to have third integral of motion. But how about the Carter constant? If I don't find the Carter constant, I'm living in a four-dimensional spacetime, but I just have three integrals of motion. My spacetime, my photon would be like super confused because, you know, the geodesics that it has, it's not integrable. So we came up with the idea that Tim Johansson talked about it in this paper of his, that they were trying to modify the Kerr spacetime in a way that they still have a modified version of Kerr Carter constant. So this Q is the Carter constant, and you can see that this is the expression for that. And we wanted to reach our previous results when we are going to non-spinning case, so we could find a map between their components and ours. And we showed that we can modify Kerr spacetime with just three independent functions, which are A1, A2, and A5. And we can find a map between A1 and A5. So these two are just our N and B. And this is the metric that I was working on for Kerr spacetime. This is looks like it's kind of similar to Kerr spacetime, but you can see that it's more complicated. And again, I went through the similar path. I started calculating R dot, then satisfying my first equation. I want to have photon circle, so I'm setting R dot equal to 0. And I should have R equal to zero if I set R dot equal to zero. And then I want to maintain having for a circular motion. So I have R double dot equal to zero. And if I want to find R gamma, I have to be able to solve these two equations simultaneously, which is basically I have to set R equal to zero and R prime at R gamma equal to zero in order to find this. And again, I went through the same procedure. I wanted to have multiple photon rings, and I wanted to start it from a little bit outside of critical impact parameter. I'm, again, assuming that the spacetime around the horizon works very well. The manifold is well-defined. And I can use the Taylor expansion. And again, I calculated. There are lots of technicality here that I'm trying to skip. Like, we know that in Keras spacetime, we have two impact parameters. This is not just one impact parameter. There's lots of, because you know, you're talking about three-dimensional object in 2D plane of sky. It's a bit of technicality here, which I'm trying to escape. But one of the assumptions that we made in order to make life a little bit easier was the fact that we know that in the M87, which was the very first image of black hole that we ever detected, the inclination that we have, which is basically the angle between the, this is our black hole and it's spinning, the spinning axis and our line of sight, they have an angle between them, which people call it inclination. And in, for this case, it's almost 17 degrees. So we assume that if you're looking at deltas that are, it's kind of close to zero, you can come up with a little bit easier case. You know, this was our huge R here. It's a bit easier if you look at the deltas that is kind of closer to zero, because you can, again, it's a come up, it's a bit of a technicality, and you can show that when the angle is kind of equal to zero, LZ would be close to zero, and you're having this R. And if you solve, again, these two simultaneously, you can see that the equations for omega and gamma are a bit easier, but not that much. And yeah, so we can, again, put some constraint on our modified version of Keras spacetime with the similar procedure of finding the shadow size and multiple photon rings. And yep, thank you. And I would be happy if you have any questions. Yeah. Yeah, sure.
When you go back to the Schwarzschild case,
I am.
I didn't really get it. You number the different rings with, you know, integers.
Yeah.
Right? But is it really separate rings, or are they kind of, you know, continuously?
Yeah, if you're looking at the very high resolution, we can see that they're actually infinite distinguishable photon rings. Because, you know, again, there are some photons coming from a very, a bit of different impact parameter. They will circulate different amount of time around the black hole. And I know, like, I feel like when you say it, it's like this deviations from critical impact parameter, it's continuous. So you're thinking that it should be continuous, right? But like the ones that are a little bit different, they will not end up at the same place that the observable is. So the observable just sees the ones that circulate two half and half around the black hole. So there are just like very distinct orbits that we can see if you're going to high resolution. Mm-hmm. And again, the sad part is that we have all of the technology and science and everything, but we don't have enough money for.
This is all the last what you were talking about.
Yeah. Yeah, but like people were with different ideas about quantum gravity, that they come up with modified version of gravity, they can actually use all of this calculations in order to check if their theory is compatible with GR or not. But like if you're going with high resolution, we can actually see some deviations and put constraint on modified version of quantum gravity, the modifications that quantum gravity will put on our classical version.
Okay, and if I understood correctly, those modifications would effectively show up that function B, is that the idea? And then that causes the differences in the rings.
Yeah, actually both of them, both N and R, both N and B with the, you know, cause deviations. Because, you know, we want it to be super, we want it to be as model agnostic as we can. So we wanted to people to be able to use our results if they're coming up with different ideas with any theory of modified gravity whether it's going to be classical or quantum or anything.
Thanks.
Yeah. This one right here. These are the radius of different, like this one, it's the M plus 2 ring, this one is M plus 1 ring, and this one is M, and we can find this for any multiple photon ring, but it will work for the higher rings better because, you know, we're assuming that we can use Taylor expansion and the ones that they are higher circulating more around the black hole, they're closer to the circular orbit, which is circulating infinite amount of time around the black hole.
And that's the Lyapunov coefficient.
Yeah, which we had as a function of our metric component.
Of the metric.
Any idea about the strength of the rings?
What do you mean by strength?
Luminosity.
Luminosity. People are like saying that all of them are kind of like, because, you know, as you can see, they're like getting exponentially further and further away. So as you get closer, you can see that they're closer and closer together. So you'll see they're like brighter, but as you can go a little bit further, you see that, you know, they're more distinct and a little bit fainter. But like each individual one of them, how much would be the brightness? I don't know.
You are trying to defy the arc here, like modify the arc by having these discrete, let's say, photon rings. Right? You also saw this and labeling there. So you want to modify the arc by having these multiple photon rings, or you have in a stable orbit around what is the signature that you're searching for to say that, okay, I'm going beyond here? Is it only the multiple photon rings, or is it, will we see like a smaller region?
You know, Bardeen in 1970, he actually calculated this for GR, actually for Kerr space time. But, you know, what we have, again, in our images is the shadow size and the multiple photon ring. And you can find that for GR. Like, for non-spinning black hole, this shadow size would be 3M for Schwarzschild. But we can see that, you know, the deviations, there are some deviations from that, like 3M plus and minus or something in the EHD observations, right? So in order to, like, quantify this deviation, we are coming up with this calculation, and I can say you can have any N, you can have any GTT, and still I can show you that the impact parameter could be this, which is the modified version of Schwarzschild, right? And as long as I'm living in this shaded region, and it's not necessarily this dashed line, which is the GR case, I can explain the observations. So this is the way that we are saying modified. Like, we're coming up with a modified version, a general modified version of gravity in order to check these deviation, in order to test this deviation. You're not actually seeing something new. We're just seeing that we have some deviations and we can put constraint on our metrics with that, metric components with that. Is that good enough for you? Okay. Yeah, sure.
When you produce the images, I think that will help to the conservation when you produce the images, you don't use any assumptions of GR.
Not necessarily GR, but people, not for the images, because, you know, the images itself, what we are actually receiving, it's the Fourier transformation of the brightness, because we have like 7 dishes in different parts of the world, and we are using interferometry methods in order to find the Fourier transformation of brightness, and people are just getting used some model imaging processes in order to get it back to this image that we have. But when people are using simulations in order to calculate mass and different things, they're using some assumption in order to, if they say if GR is correct, this would be the mass that we are seeing, but like there are lots of other experiments, like, you know, the dynamics of the disk around the black hole, the jet, and lots of other experiments to see it too, which will come up with a, it gets a closer to the model agnostic version of it.
Okay, very good. Let's thank Kiana one more time.
Thank you.